when I was 20 years old, I was convicted of armed robbery and felony firearm and sentenced to 3 to 15 years in the Michigan Department of Corrections. 2007 is actually when I caught my case, and I wasn't convicted until 2008. And I was released in 2010, so it's been going on 12 years now.
Today, we are joined by Ashley Golden for the final episode of the season to discuss how time is experienced while incarcerated. Ashley is currently a doctoral candidate at the University of Southern California studying social work, where her focus is on systems innovation and nonprofit leadership. She is also a 2021 Just Leadership Fellow and the statewide program director of Nation Outside, a group of formerly incarcerated people who are working around advocacy reform in Michigan.
I think that it's important to storytell around my experience around being incarcerated because it helps with changing the narrative. And when we make mistakes, that doesn't define our lives or who we are as a person.
I'm Bhavana.
And I'm Vandala. And this is Women's Health Incarcerated. So Ashley, what was it like being incarcerated?
It was incredibly challenging. It was the most challenging time I've faced in my entire life. And I have a significant history of complex and compound trauma as a child. And so having been a traumatized, troubled, quote unquote, teenager, and then going into the carceral state was even more harmful, I would say. We can't heal our nation by treating its most damaged citizens like animals. A lot of people will look at all my accomplishments and what I've been able to persevere through, and they might make the mistake of thinking that prison is the thing that changed my life, and that couldn't be farther from the truth. The system actually motivated me because even in my challenging youth, I was always an advocate for forward thinking and what was right and standing up for myself and being vocal. And so realizing that the system does nothing but kick people while they're already down, I wanted to use my experience and my lived expertise to create a system that builds people back up. And so it was just an incredibly harmful, non-productive use of some of the best years of my life that I could have been learning and improving. And, you know, when we get into trouble, that really puts us in a mental place to want to change because it causes us to reflect. And that opportunity that you have to do that is really what you make of it, because the system offers very little resources, very little guidance, very little education when it comes to rehabilitation. You go through a lot of assessments when you first get there, and they're not explained to you, and no one asks your permission. So the assessments might require you to go through a substance recovery program or an anger management program before you're released. However, those programs are not available to you until you are ready for release. So let's say, for instance, myself, I went in 2008. I wouldn't have been able to receive that type of programming until I was ready to walk out the door 3 years later. And it's interesting the way things work in there. I was able to take a couple of correspondence college classes towards a business entrepreneur certificate. However, before I was able to finish, they canceled the program. I did end up getting a couple credits, and it was great. You know, while it lasted, it really fed my mind and it gave me something to do to stay busy. But then they just cut it. There was no explanation. There was no, you know, it was just like, we're not doing that anymore. It didn't work. As a quote-unquote inmate, you're just a number. They don't explain things to you. You know, that's not something that they do. it was sad, and it was hard because, you know, for me, I had the support of my grandmother on the outside and a couple friends, and you know, I had assignments and I had to look up information, and there's no computers, and there's not, you know, you might have access to a typewriter, but usually the, you know, the big law advocate on the unit is using that. So, you know, I had to call and make phone calls and get my people to go out and find this information for me. And it would have been great if I had the access to the resources I needed to complete the classes in there. You know, I was lucky enough to have enough money to make phone calls and had people to answer the phone, right? But that's not always the case. In fact, most of the time, that's not the case.
How would you feel like time is experienced in prison?
Every minute feels like an hour, like every hour feels like a day. Time passes so slowly. And it's because you have nothing to do but play, you know, play cards or talk to people, watch TV. You know, there's nothing to feed your mind. Even book access is limited, you know, and they ban certain books. And it's just, you know, that the average person spends about 39,000 hours inside and isn't able to utilize that time in a beneficial way. I'll give you another example. In Genesee County, there's a program called Ignite in the jail there. And every resident has access to a tablet or a Chromebook. And Captain Jason Gould there was explaining to me that the critical incidents, the fighting, the aggression, the issues between staff and residents, all of those things have declined significantly since they've allowed access to this technology. And when you go on the floor now, it sounds like a library. Whereas before, there was, you know, they say that idle time is the devil's playground, right? And you compound that with the fact that you're treated like a number. People are telling you that your life is over with. How do you then use that idle time for good? Usually you're just like soaking in the desperation and the scarcity and the, you know, hopelessness. So just since we started 6 months ago, we've already had 15 residents graduate from high school and receive employment, not just minimum wage paying jobs, but real sustainable living wages, like linemen at GM, AutoZone, tech worker. The change is really, you know, you won't understand it until you talk to the individuals that are in the program. We had a young lady who broke down crying, and she said that she was just sentenced to 25 years. She thought that her life was over, but now she realizes that it's just beginning. So those are the type of transformations that you see when you empower individuals, not just with technology, but with dignity and respect, with resources to meet their basic needs. Those are the things that make the difference. After my college classes were canceled, I knew that I wanted to be successful, and I knew I wasn't going to take no for an answer. And I knew that my life was only over if I let it be over. And I made a promise to myself that I would overcome by any means necessary. So what I started doing was making a blueprint of the businesses I wanted to start, the efforts I wanted to be involved in. Every moment of free time I had, I tried to utilize towards bettering myself. And what I found was it was contagious, because my peers would wonder why I was always writing in my book and what these numbers were and why am I budgeting, you know, for imaginary businesses. And they started doing it too. People shouldn't have to be left to their own devices for that, because the hunger is there. People want to be better. People want to overcome. People want to tap into their greatness. But the system is preventing them from doing that. It's not supporting them in doing that. It's not empowering them to do those things. It's crazy to me how we have this premise of like time heals all, and it's such flawed logic. Time is nothing without action. When you imprison millions of broken people, young and old, year after year, without providing them any hope or resources, you can expect them to repeat the cycle. Have you ever cooked macaroni and cheese? Like, we're young people, right? Like, well, me not so much anymore, but you leave your dishes in the sink and you don't put them in a dishwasher. You get back to it the next day, they're still dirty and they're harder to clean. When you are driving and your little engine light comes on and you ignore it, right? Your car's gonna break down. Just because you put it in the garage for the winter time doesn't mean in spring you can hop in and start driving again. That's just not how it works. You need service. You need services, not sentences. Time merely opens a window of opportunity for action. And for decades, public health administrators have been missing it. And so I'm happy to say that I'm one now and I can bring that to my colleagues' attention.
Can you speak a bit more on how trauma-impacted people may be more vulnerable to being impacted by the system?
Having gone through, I've been through abuse, I've been through neglect, I've been exploited, like, I've been marginalized, I've been, called N-words and other things, and still that doesn't compare to what I experienced at the hands of the system, which is controlled by our government. Okay, bad things happen, right? But then more bad things happen, when you're a ward of the state. That's crazy. My first week in quarantine, which is, where you go when you first go into the penitentiary, you have to be isolated until, your medical clearances and all these assessments that they don't explain to you and all that stuff is done. Of course, all of that is incredibly delayed because we're overpopulated, right? We're understaffed. So, you spend 2 months in quarantine before you can have access to the phone and, conversations with your peers and all those social things. But my first week there, a captain came into the bathroom and pulled the shower curtain to watch me shower. I'm 21 years old, and I'm a young, immature, 21, right? Like, I don't know. I didn't know about a grievance process. I'm thinking this is like, this is what happens? Like, this is inmate golden. And I run down because, what do they want? And they rip up a bunch of paper and throw it in there and say, clean it up. My first night there, like, they purposely try to scare you, like, especially if you, young or whatever, if you, your first time, The officer, kick the door in, like, boom! Like, your house is being broken into by people, like thugs on the street, which has also happened to me before. So why is that okay? In what professional industry do we treat people like that? We cannot expect to heal trauma by exacerbating it. We need standards. We need ethics. We need values. These are things that are inherent to social work. These are things that are inherent in law, right? They have high standards in the court. They have very high ethical standards to be a lawyer, to be in the healthcare industry. You take a Hippocratic oath, do no harm. When you go to prison, though, punishment is the solution. I was talking to a friend of mine and we're trying to advocate for more rights in solitary confinement. when you're in there, you get dinner at about 4 or 5 p.m. And the portions aren't big, right? They're very small, and the food is terrible, as I'm sure everyone in the nation has heard, right? That's a stereotype, you know, that's a true stereotype about prison. It's terrible. And then you don't get your next meal. You don't get a snack. It's not camp. You know what I'm saying? You don't get your next meal until 5 or 6 a.m. the next day. Well, that's kind of like starving people a little bit. And, you know, the mass consensus is like, well, people, they get what they deserve, and they made the decisions to go into solitary confinement through their poor behavior. But they're missing the point, because segregation is for just that. It's to separate, right? When there's a risk, we want to alleviate the risk by placing this person outside the group. That's why we're doing it, because they've heightened the risk. They've lowered safety. And so we need to put them to the side. That doesn't mean we need to torture them. That doesn't mean we need to starve them. And the same thing is true when you look at the penitentiary as a whole. Its purpose should be to separate and to work on those things that, you know, go into people finding themselves there. Not to cause harm or to treat them like less than a person or to treat them like a number. That just doesn't work. We've seen that.
What was your experience like being incarcerated as a gender nonconforming individual?
Coming into prison, being gender nonconforming is, you get treated differently. You get treated differently by staff, and some of that is for safety, but some of that is also harmful. Like, they put me in a room by myself without a roommate just off the premise that I look gay and gender nonconforming. So instead of me having a bunkie where I could socialize and have someone to talk to, like, I was in quarantine by myself the whole time. It was like solitary. And I didn't think that was fair. And just like being looked at as more aggressive than I really am, just because I am more androgynous, I'm just perceived a little bit differently.
Ashley, can you talk more about what you've been up to since you got out of prison? What's it like being a social worker with all of these lived experiences of the criminal legal system?
I actually had my first organizing experience in undergrad. I didn't know that it was organizing experience. I simply just wanted to be able to find entry-level work in my field. My undergraduate degree is in psychology. And I had obtained a work study through my professors, who thought I was so great. They were like, you got to do this work study. So I was creating newsletters for all the programs at the school, including psychology and our master's counseling program. And I knew that it would require 6 months experience for entry level work. At the same time, my mentors asked me if I would lead the efforts in creating their first student organization. And so I geared it towards service work and volunteer work, because I knew it was a resume builder. The feeling of giving back made me feel better as a person. And I knew when I was on the inside that I wanted to use everything that I went through for the betterment of society and myself. So we did countless service projects, and I was able to grow that organization to a little over 40 members. We started like a softball team, and it was crazy, right? Like, there's just a sense of community and agency, and it was so rewarding. And through that, I met one of the graduate counseling professors, and she was telling us that she was on her way to Vista Maria to pitch for internships there for her graduate students. And I asked her to pitch me while she was going. And I gave her my resume because I was excited about the thought of working with juvenile justice youth, system impact of youth, because I thought in my mind, if I had someone that understood, right, like no one understood me as a kid, like I'm biracial, I'm adopted, gender not conforming, like there wasn't one person that understood me as a youth. And I wanted to try to help. I wanted to try to prevent. So she went and she pitched me, and I was able to secure an interview for an internship. And their premise was, hey, if we didn't give people second chances, if we didn't believe that people could turn around, then what are we even doing? They are one of the largest residential treatment facilities in the Metro Detroit area for system impacted youth. And so they gave me a chance. And it was so awesome and rewarding. And I learned so much. It was kind of surreal though, because once I graduated, they offered me employment and I was able to start on the floor as a direct care service worker. And so essentially, I went from being inside the carceral system as a resident, and now I'm supervising residents in a residential institution. So it was very surreal. But I was able to run a lot of educational groups. I was able to connect with a lot of families. You know, I was really responsible for catalyzing some of the change in beliefs that had been prevalent there for so long, because historically speaking, juvenile justice has been very punitive. But as you know, in the recent 3 years, 4 years now, they passed Family First Prevention Services Act that mandates trauma-informed care and family-based services across all juvenile justice landscape. I'm trauma-informed innately. So I was able to do a lot of great things. And that's when I got interested in social work, because social work is the applied version of service. So I started my master's in macro social work at the University of Southern California. I was a 2018-2019 Dean Scholarship recipient, and I graduated summa cum laude last year. That was like the greatest accomplishment ever, right? Like, except for I also left my legacy there by pioneering an official student caucus for system impacted graduate students of social work, which is the first of its kind in the nation. Unchained Scholars, you got to check them out. So that was kind of like my transition in the social work. I can say that to explain what it's been like, what it feels like is like an iterative, dichotomous gamut of reward and frustration, reward and frustration, reward and frustration. Because, you know, social work as a profession has been around for a long time. But a lot of the problems that we're facing today in society have also been around for a long time. There's this incrementalism that is prevalent, not just in social work, but amongst a lot of the systems that hold mass incarceration up. And social workers, unfortunately, have also been prejudiced towards formerly incarcerated people. It's until very recently that they're becoming more empathetic and compassionate, and that's because they are starting to realize the value of that lived expertise. We saw it in the substance abuse sector. We saw it in the mental health sector. Why wouldn't it work for reentry, right? Like, why wouldn't it work in the justice sector? So smart decarceration is the euphemism for ending mass incarceration. Smart decarceration is the premise that, yes, we have incredibly overpopulated prisons and jails. It says that the methods that cause people to enter the system is flawed and biased. It says that we can do better. Prisons and jails, like separating people from the things that they need to thrive, should be reserved as a last resort. Is there utility in separating people from society for rehabilitative purposes? When absolutely necessary, yes. But that's not what's being done right now. What's being done is that we're imprisoning disproportionately BIPOC populations. And that goes into the whole premise that the justice system and prisons and jails were built on. They were built on the slave patrol. They did not increase in capacity and scale all across the nation until the 13th Amendment. And even then, in the 13th Amendment, there's still a slavery clause in there. So if you're incarcerated, you can still be a slave. That's still in our Constitution. And that was the equivalent of, you know, when you try to get a law passed and there's these negotiations back and forth between parties. And it's like, well, we want to free the slaves. And the pushback there is like, well, no, well, we'll throw you a little bone, though, so we can still get it passed. And we never went back and looked at that. That's still in there. The very premise of the system is wrong. It needs to be reframed.
What are your visions for the future of the incarceration system and the role that it plays in this country?
I envision a future where our society and communities are safe and vibrant, where all people are treated with dignity and respect, and where justice and equity is accessible to all. And again, in order to do this, we need to reframe our approach towards justice and our use of institutions. We cannot heal our nation by treating its most damaged citizens like animals. We need to reimagine and we need to rethink. We need to create a system that transforms people's lives, that transforms communities, that helps people and doesn't hurt them or drag them down. To say, if we do need to separate you from society, then how can we make sure that you still have everything that you need when you leave to thrive or while you're here to thrive? And that increases safety for all. It increases financial equity for all. And it eliminates the systematic racism and prejudice against marginalized populations and people that have been incarcerated. It sounds very simple, you know, but there's so much that goes into it, and we can't even begin to make those changes until we convince the people that believe the system should be used for punishment should not be.
Okay, Ashley, so before we let you go, we just wanted to ask you a few little icebreaker questions that we had. So the first thing that we wanted to ask you is, what is the first thing you thought about when you woke up this morning?
Coffee and greatness. Not necessarily in that order.
Do you have coffee every morning?
Yes.
Nice.
Are you guys there yet? Coffee in the morning?
No. I definitely have it, but I don't think it's because I need it. It's more just because I like the feeling that I'm starting the morning off with a cup of coffee.
That's how I started. Yeah, you'll get there. Don't worry.
Okay, awesome.
No, I'm not a coffee person. I'm very much a tea person.
Okay, so you still get your caffeine in.
Yeah. All right, so for our second question, what or who inspires you in life and in work and all the different areas?
Oh, so many people, so many things. Mm-hmm. That's, again, like a loaded question. I did bring a quote with me, though. It's a quote from Plato's Allegory of the Cave, mm-hmm. and it's something I came across in my undergraduate English class, and it really was like the fork in the road for me. And it goes like this. It is the task of the enlightened not only to ascend to learning and to see the good, but to be willing to descend again, even in the prospect of death.
Wow.
And so I just thought when I read that the first time, it was synonymous to my life's purpose mm-hmm. and my life's mission. Because once you know better, you are then obligated to not just do better, but to inspire others to do so too.
Wow. Yeah, I really love that.
And I feel like I can resonate with it because I feel like I think very similarly, like I really enjoy learning and then spreading what I learn. And then if I need to relearn or gain new insight, you know, the more that I share what I know, then that's even better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I feel like I don't have too much more to add to what you just said.
Fair enough. Okay, so for our last question, what is your favorite smell?
That is such a weird, odd question. So I'm really indecisive, mm-hmm. and I have lots of smells that bring fond memories. But I think my favorite one is probably the fresh air of the night. Just because I was deprived of that, you know, for so many years, mm-hmm. and it's something that I'll never take for granted again. Mm-hmm. You know, having fresh air and being under the stars and the moon, and yeah, so that's my favorite smell.
Wow. That's really lovely. I feel like your answer was too poetic for me to follow up with, because I was gonna say that my favorite smell is something like freshly baked cake, because I just really love sweets. So
yeah, cake is good too.
Cake is definitely good. I also love those candles.
I like candles too. I'm a big candle.
Yeah, like the ones that smell like the beach or the ocean or
Bath and Body Works gets you in trouble.
Yeah, there's too many fun candles there, and you know, like other stuff that just smells awesome.
Yeah, I'm hit. It's a whole lot.
All right. Well, Ashley, that's all the questions that we had for you. Thank you so, so much for coming on and for, you know, helping us wrap up the final episode for the season. It was such a pleasure to be able to meet you and to hear your story and to hear about all the incredible work that you're doing. We wish you all the best for that. Thank you so much again. And I'm so excited to be able to see all the amazing things that I'm sure you will be doing in the future.
Thank you. And thank you for having me. And thank you for giving me a platform. I appreciate you. Your work that is so important. And I wish you the best. But hopefully we'll connect again.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode. That marks the end of a truly wonderful season. We are so grateful to all of our guests, mentors, and team members for supporting us through this production process, and we are so humbled and happy that you all, our incredible listeners, joined us on this journey to learn and understand the realities of being behind bars. We look forward to connecting with you again for season 3. Until then,
Women's Health Incarcerated can be found on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. To view our transcripts, learn more information about the intersection between the incarceration system and healthcare, or find different ways that you could get involved, please visit www.linkthemovement.org. That's www.whincthemovement.org.